Investing in AI podcast. I'm Rob May, a partner of PJC. And the purpose of this podcast is really to look at the ideas at markets and products that are going to affect how we look at the future of artificial intelligence. So I'd like to welcome my guest today, Amy Webb, from the Future Today Institute. Amy, thanks for being on the podcast.
Hey, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's jump right in. And I want to start by talking about your book, The Big Nine. So in it, you cover the promise and peril of AI. And what I found so interesting about this is the tech industry has gotten a lot wrong over the last 30 years. You know, we thought the web would be great for democracy, and it's become this tool that was used to sort of isolate viewpoints and put democracy at risk. We thought blogging and social media would enable the citizen journalist movement and go around the mainstream media, and then they were being terrible gatekeepers, and now we're begging them to fact check everything for us. So do you actually have any hope that we get it right with AI this time?
Well, I've got hope that we get it right, but I think it's useful to unpack maybe a little bit of how we got here and what you originally said, which is, you know, a lot of times the tech world gets things wrong. I think it's useful to think about why that's the case. My observation is that there's tremendous optimism that the decisions that are made, the new ideas that are generated, the startups, the products, the tools, that they're going to be beneficial and they're going to help businesses or they're going to help people. I don't think anybody starts out saying, you know, I want to build a product that's going to bring down humankind. I mean, at least I hope that's not the case. I don't know if anybody watches Phineas and Ferb, but we grew up with my daughter was hooked on that show, and it's a character named Dr. Doofenshmirtz who's constantly making bad stuff. I don't think that's what's happening.
Yeah.
So instead, I think what's happening is you get people with very good intentions working on projects that are hard, that take dedication and time and effort. And part of getting those products out of a lab or out of a laptop and into the world requires investment. And in order to get investors excited, I mean, you probably know this better than anybody, you got to sell them on the idea. And at some point, I think there's this artificial layer, an exuberant layer of optimism that never gets tempered. And I'm not saying not to be optimistic. I'm saying you got to temper that optimism sometimes with, you know, the boring pragmatic questions like, hey, in what ways could this amazing idea that we have cause some future harm? You know, in what ways are we setting others up to be vulnerable, or are we setting ourselves up for future vulnerabilities? It's useful to ask those strategic questions. And the very act of asking those types of strategic questions is futures thinking. I mean, it is imagining alternative pathways. And unfortunately, I think that just doesn't happen enough. And now the markets move so fast and there's so much change that there's very little appetite to stop and ask those questions and to think about risk.
Do you think that we're looking at, because of the problems that we've had in the past, do you think we're going to think differently about AI? Like, have you been doing this for a while? Have you seen a difference in people being maybe more concerned or more pragmatic and thoughtful about AI? Or do you worry that we're still going to, you know, continue to sort of not think through this as much as we should?
Well, I'd love to give you a super recent example to explore that question. Did you see the new demo from OpenAI Codex?
I did, yes.
Yeah, so it's pretty mind-blowing. And for those who have not played with it yet or seen it, you know, imagine being able to use very simple natural language, kind of like how we're talking right now. Describe what you want, and have a model pop out on the other end, right? And have, like, I mean, this isn't quite what it does, but sort of imagine describing a game you might want to play, and then having that game appear in a, you know, in a usable form with all the stuff you need to make it work. Or being able to describe how you want a document formatted. And rather than, as I do, spending an hour trying to find where in the buttons and menu tree that one particular formatting thing is, just being able to describe what you want and having the problem solved or fixed. From my point of view, this is incredibly powerful stuff, but I wonder how much we've thought through what the potential negative implications could be. You know, so again, this is like not to rain on OpenAI's parade in any way. It is, though, asking, have we thought through all of the future permutations of this? Because the question that I get asked the most is, you know, when are the walking, talking robots going to come and take our jobs and then murder us in our sleep? Like when does artificial general intelligence get here is like the question that everybody asks, that everybody wants to know. And from my point of view, it doesn't really matter because OpenAI, like, because we've already got things that are doing, you know, we've already got tools that offer us glimpses of what a world might look like in which we don't need humans in the loop the way that we do now.
Yeah, you know, and it's one of the things that people don't think about is it like we're already getting there with some things. I've talked a lot about you take a tool like Waze, right, that sort of routes people around, and you have this idea of like, you know, it starts to learn our habits, and like, what if it learns that, you know, you normally leave the house at 8:45 and arrive at work at 9:30, and I normally leave the house at 8:30 and arrive at 9 o'clock, and like, you know, I'm running a little late one day, you're running a little early. Like, does Waze, you know, route you a different way so it'll go slower? And I, like, how does it make those decisions? And should it make those level of optimizations? And if so, is it driven because one of us is a more one of us has a higher social ranking, one of us is more valuable to advertisers or whatever? But you know, you're going to get into some really interesting questions of AI controlling our lives long before you have artificial general intelligence.
Totally. And I think you're raising a really insightful point, Rob, which is who is being optimized for and why? And I think we don't have easy answers to that question. And there are ways to address the question and to make the answers transparent. And that's to just make the, you know, require some transparency in, at the very least, some of the strategic decision-making that goes into who's being optimized for, under what circumstances and why, that I don't think would compromise any proprietary information or threaten somebody's business model. But we're going to have to address those questions. Right now, it's such an opaque area. I mean, even OpenAI is sort of like not very open. You know, there's a lot that's opaque there. And I think if we're going to move forward in a way that is that makes the future of artificial intelligence very people focused, but also staves off what could otherwise be future regulation, then I think we have to take this approach where we like make some of this stuff more clear.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, you started the Future Today Institute to think about things like this. And when I was sort of researching the Institute, I found a lot of mentions of this idea of complex systems. And so I'm interested in your take on, has the world gotten more complex? And like, what does that mean? And then what does it mean for navigating markets and products and companies and technologies?
So complex, from my point of view, and I'm sure somebody who is a scientist who researches this would probably disagree with me. But from my vantage point, complexity is relative to the institution, the organization, or the person who's in the middle of that system or thinking about a system. So relative to 100 years ago, yeah, of course, things are much more complex than they used to be. And I think the challenge right now has to do with uncertainty. You know, even pre-COVID, most organizations were dealing with an untenable amount of uncertainty, whether that was policy uncertainty, because we've had so much of a pendulum swing in DC, and certainly with other governments around the world, or complexity because it's become much more challenging to figure out, you know, how different tech ecosystems are maturing and at what rate. And some of that has to do with investment cycles, but like some of that has to do with once you hit a critical mass of research and you've got, you know, you've got products and services that are working, or you've got prototypes, that usually turns into a super cycle of innovation and additional research and development. Sometimes it's really hard to figure out what the timing on that looks like. So I would say the complexity is more pronounced in part because we've got all of these interconnected systems now that are challenging. And we have what I would call like a soul crushing amount of deep uncertainty, some of which was present before COVID, you know, but much of it now is COVID related. And it's not just related to COVID, it's related to, you know, COVID plus N, right? Which is, where are we going to be working? What does travel look like? How do global supply chains, you know, how are they impacted? The geopolitical lines have been redrawn a little bit, alliances because of COVID and China and, you know, so forth and so on. Did I answer your question? I just kind of rambled.
Yeah, you did. So,
what does it mean for navigating markets and products and companies? It means it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
But I guess very specifically, maybe my observation. So most of what I do and what my team does is we work with executive management teams. So we are almost exclusively working with the C-suite and boards of directors by extension. I think there's less and less appetite to do longer term planning because everybody's dealing with fires they have to put out. I mean, some of them are literally thinking about fires because of climate change. There's a sense, I'm noticing this sort of interesting tension. On the one hand, a lot of companies and industries got caught without a plan. And so COVID decimated their growth or, you know, just caused all kinds of problems. So on the one hand, you've got some people in organizations wanting to do foresight and long-term planning, but there's a tension between those people and the people who tend to work in other, you know, parts of the organization that have more to do with immediate needs like finance and supply chain and stuff like that, or investments, you know, and they're very much in the mindset that we can't plan for the next, you know, 5 years, let alone 12 months. There's too much in flux. Resolving that tension is going to be key for every organization or every investor attempting to navigate, you know, the tricky waters right now of markets, products, and companies.
Yeah, and I think that's complicated. I think you're right, and I think it's made worse by the fact that, you know, I sit here in Boston on the board of the New England Complex Systems Institute, and one of the things that we talk about a lot is that just the past isn't as useful of a guide to the future as it used to be, right? And by looking backwards, you can't predict as much about the future as you used to be. Some things don't change, maybe some things related to human behavior and traits like that, but a lot of the world is very, very different and more different all the time. So,
yeah, I think that's a good point. When my observation is that when there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty, we tend to look for patterns that we recognize. And some of this is neurological. Our brains are wired to seek out patterns to help us distill the information that's around us. But there's also some amount of comfort because while everything, all of the signal data may be brand new and constantly changing, the pattern, or at least adhering to a pattern or looking for a historical pattern, feels familiar. And therefore it feels like there's less uncertainty. So I would argue, if anything, you have to study history, and futurists spend just as much time looking back as we do forward. But it's a good reminder that historical precedent may or may not apply, because we're living through, like, humanity's, at least in modern times, greatest, weirdest, multivariate regression. Just like,
it's a good way to put
stuff
it.
Happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now, a few months ago, you published your 2021 Tech Trends report, and I'm really interested in sort of three pieces from the artificial intelligence section of that report. First of all, the enterprise piece. So what is your take on Is enterprise adopting AI at the pace that you would expect? And what do you think the impact will be on large companies that aren't particularly technical? Are they going to figure this out or not?
I don't know what the pace of investment is. I can tell you what the pace of conversation is. I think, again, like pre-COVID, I think there was this understanding that there needed to be investment made in, you know, automated systems and optimizing for discovery and search and stuff like that. But unless there was a immediate business case to be made, I observed that there wasn't a lot of urgency. COVID changed that, right? Businesses that had held off on digital transformation and, investing more in cloud and thinking about AI as a service and all that stuff, suddenly were faced with the consequences of having not done that work in advance. I think that path to digitization and AI has certainly sped up. But now the problem is talent. Every client that we have worked with in the past 12 months, and these tend to be enormous corporations that are multinationals, they can't hire enough people. We're dealing with a company right now that I think has 200 open positions just in the realm of what I would call sort of greater AI services. So that includes a lot of different things, but people who would come out of like Stanford or an equivalent having taken a natural language processing class, that, there's not enough people to go around. So right. I think what happened was everybody was kind of meandering. Suddenly there's this cataclysmic event coupled with the fact that executives are now more aware of what opportunities there are in automation, synthetic content generation, whatever it might be, synthetic code generation. And so now there's this like mad rush in the enterprise to adopt AI, to hire people, to build out those capabilities, and they're struggling.
Yeah. So now I've seen the same thing on the investing side, right? It's not just the big companies. I mean, small companies, it's a new skill set and a lot of people are struggling with it. So let's move on and talk about another part of that Tech Trends report, which was health and medicine. So, the naysayers will say that, well, AI is difficult to do on healthcare data because AI requires a lot of data and healthcare has all kinds of data related issues. And then other people say, well, it's such a complex space that it's actually really ideal for AI because it's hard for humans to monitor and understand everything and look at all the data. So I'm curious, like, where did your report come down on sort of AI for health and medicine?
So I have a different take on this. And partially, I've got a little bit of an inside view on this one. My husband's a doctor. The problem, I think, one of the problems for AI and health and medicine has to do, at least in the United States and probably Europe, it has to do with where the data are. So part of the problem is a lot of the data are that you would want to use to build your models and train your models and do the research are protected in some way under HIPAA. So at least in the United States, what that means is it's really, really hard unless you have a group of people who have opted in a very specific way. It's hard to get the massive amount of data that you would need in a way that you could actually use it. The other challenge has to do with the electronic health records, EHRs, or electronic medical records, EMRs, which is essentially like the content management system equivalent in the health world that stores and moves data records around. And they're all proprietary and they make those data, the data are like structured, but they make it so challenging even to move between partners. And
right.
It's not like there's one system. It's not like there's a WordPress equivalent for like your health data. all the subspecialties have their own versions of this. Within optometry, which is one teeny tiny little sliver of our health ecosystem in the United States, there are three competing systems, which, and technically the data are structured, but they're not interoperable across those three systems. So if you have to migrate to another one, like, you're totally screwed. So my point is this: if you're a huge company and you're trying to get data to build out applications or to do learning or whatever it is that you're trying to do, it's going to be nearly impossible for you to get the data that you need, which is why I think, and again, this is my point of view, this is the criticism that IBM Watson withstood a couple of years ago, I think is the result of synthetic data sets that had to get used.
Right.
They had some partnerships. You know, there was a lot of apprehension, which I get, you know, like radiologists, oncologists, they don't want to feel like their jobs are being replaced. The EHRs were a beast to deal with. And I believe a lot of that training data was synthetic. And the synthetic data wasn't automatically generated by OpenAI or something like that. It was generated by people. And, you know, we're going to miss stuff. So if you have bad data in, you're going to wind up with bad data on the other side. Now, look at the opposite of this situation, where I think health and AI and medicine are actually working out pretty well, is Estonia. Interesting stuff going on in Estonia in general, but there's only, what's the population there? It's tiny. It's like less than 4 million people, I think. It might even be fewer than that. And the government started a program asking people to opt in for the purpose of study, like aggregating, collating, you know, cleaning up their health data and then actioning it so that you could learn, right? You can build some of the AI tools and do some of the learning and everything else. And something crazy, I'm going to get this number wrong, so I'm saying that in advance, but it was somewhere in the realm of like 80% of the people opted in. Knowingly, full understanding, they'd like opted into the system where it wasn't just signing away your data. It was also like being part of community programs and learning and understanding what was happening and, you know, being an active participant in this process. The downside to that is Estonia is not a super diverse place. So the genetic profile, like the data that are part of this national data bank is going to be, you know, somewhat limited. But we're not even close to being able to do that in the US, which therefore advantages companies that are partnering with the big scale tech companies like a Google or an Amazon. That's why I think right. Amazon's, I mean, we, in the report this year, we have an entire section just on what I, you know, what we think Amazon's healthcare ambitions are and what we think Amazon is doing, just really interesting. I think very, very compelling, but it makes sense that a huge tech company would be anchoring all of this work through consumers opting in versus it coming from the healthcare sector, which created so many problems for itself.
Right. No, that's a great point. So let's move on to the part of your report that maybe I'm personally most concerned about, which is geopolitics and how that impacts AI. And so there have been some books written like AI Superpowers about sort of the AI Cold War between the US and China, as some people call it. And I've seen data showing that China has passed the US in AI research in terms of number of papers published. But some of the newsletters I subscribe to that are related to this and some of the people that I've met have also said, well, but China's social system sort of props up bad ideas and they don't have the best of the best research. The top papers are still here. So I'm curious, what did you learn about China versus the US and the rest of the world, the geopolitical aspects of AI as part of your report?
So I think it's, again, useful to bear in mind that Xi Jinping has been now in power for almost a decade. And China has been under, so the Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping has been very, very transparent about its ambitions in two key areas. One is artificial intelligence. The other is synthetic biology. And those two areas actually go hand in hand. you know, artificial intelligence isn't a tech trend. It's not an individual thing. You know, it's the next era of computing that underpins everything else. And it becomes a sort of a force multiplier across many different industries, which therefore makes sense why China is interested in it. Also important to note, you know, China's got an enormous population and an economy that's going to have to keep growing. So it cannot therefore continue to be the world's, you know, sort of old school manufacturing center. It's going to have to do other things. So it's not just that this is a sort of battle between the United States and China. This is also a battle for China's long-term survivability. It's battling itself in a way. And as a result, it's poured significant resources into preparing for a future in which, in many ways, it's dominating what that future looks like. So there are textbooks, the national textbooks teach different elements of AI now, starting in kindergarten. There are more Chinese educated, there were more Chinese educated people, I don't know how to say this, more papers at Neural IPS whose authors were Chinese educated researchers than anybody else. And I think that's a pretty interesting data point, because if you look at the number of people coming out of Stanford's natural language, Stanford's core AI classes, those numbers are way up. So there's a weird asymmetry, not weird, but there's an asymmetry, right? We're pumping out in the United States a lot of people going through these programs, but the elite work, at least as far as academic journals are concerned, is coming from China. And that matters because that research becomes the foundation for what happens, who's making selections on frameworks and who's making decisions about things. And there are some hefty, formidable players coming out of China, like Alibaba, Baidu, and Tencent, and also SenseTime and, you know, a bunch of other companies. And this ties into some domestic policy, like China's Made in China 2025 plan, announcements that prioritize Chinese-made goods and services over foreign-made goods and services. You know, a effort to re-educate kids and younger people, so Gen Z and very young millennials, to get them excited about what's happening in China, to favor a more nationalistic outlook. And the backdrop to all of this is a policy called the Belt and Road Initiative, which in a way is the world's largest infrastructure. It's the largest global infrastructure project ever conceived. And the idea is to sort of build roads, bridges, core infrastructure in emerging markets, connecting China to Southeast Asia, Europe, and Africa. But it's not just a physical infrastructure project. It's also a digital infrastructure project. And part of what's being built and decided on involves Huawei. So my point in sort of giving you this backdrop is this is a really gnarly, complex area. And the reason that it matters to people outside of China is because at some point, if you're a company or you're an investor or you're heading up a PE or firm or a VC firm or whatever it is, and you're on the wrong side of these deals, you're going to find that it's much harder to do business than it used to be.
Right.
You don't agree, for example, with what's happening in Western China, but at the moment your supply chain relies on China as a primary source, you know, you're going to have some problems. If China's your primary market, or you decided that China's going to be your primary market for whatever reason, you're going to have to make some difficult decisions going forward, precisely because of all of this development in AI. So this is, you know, that this gets thrown around a lot, that there's this new Cold War pitting China against the United States. And I would argue that's really oversimplifying the situation that we're in, especially when you consider that AI development is very tightly linked to development in synthetic biology, which involves, it's sort of an umbrella term in much the same way that AI is an umbrella term, but it involves things like CRISPR and messenger RNA and all that stuff.
Right. Now, you mentioned before when we were talking about IBM, this idea of synthetic data. That's an area that I've spent a lot of time looking at. We've made some investments there at my firm. And we've watched this sort of next generation of this space as well, the synthetic media space. It's interesting because some of the synthetic media stuff can tie back to some geopolitical issues and everything else. And there's a lot of great applications of this technology, but there's also some dangerous ones. So I'm interested, like when you look forward at the future, like what do you see as some of the benefits that we'll get from synthetic data and synthetic media and the things that are coming from them? And what do you think some of the risks are for society? And do you think we're prepared for those?
Well, I know I've been talking a lot about natural language processing. I'm going to give another example. But I think it's a good one because when people think about synthetic media, I think they immediately jump to like a little Michaela or a synthetic character. And I actually think the applications are much more profound, but in a more narrow way. So let me give you an example. So going back to GPT-3 and OpenAI for just a moment. So the GPT-3, one of the examples that were part of the demo showed a chair in the shape of an avocado, right? And this was the result of somebody querying, like, show me an avocado chair. And then the system spit out multiple versions of very real-looking chairs in the shape of an avocado.
Right.
That on its own is interesting, but here's where I think the real benefit and the real interesting application is. What if I actually did want a chair in the shape of an avocado, and I described it as best as I could? That would generate an image. I could then use like a computer vision system of some kind to use that image to search against, let's say, all images in a marketplace somewhere. This application of synthetic media profoundly changes how we think about search and optimizing for search. Many people are more visual in how they think, and the internet and the way that we get to information is in many ways not visual. It's it's based in traditional language.
Right.
So from my point of view, there are lots of interesting applications of synthetic media beyond what you've seen in like science fiction movies and shows that could drastically alter in a very positive way how we look for information. So I think that there are great benefits. I'll also mention, so I've got this book coming out, and a new book coming out in February. And my publisher is creating, there's always galleys, which are these, before books go out, they're versions that reviewers can read in advance. But, you know, a lot of people prefer eBooks. So we were talking and I was like, hey, why don't we do like an eBook galley in addition to the other ones? And they said, cool. Is there a company you like? Anyhow, long story short, the ebook galley is read by Edward Herman, who's an actor that has actually died in 2013. He's got a very recognizable voice. He did the best FDR in any show that I saw. At any rate, it's amazing how good he sounds. It is shockingly good. Nothing about it sounds robotic. I played it for several people to see what their reactions were. And basically the reactions were either, why did you pick a guy to read the ebook? Why did you pick a guy to read the book? So it's separate. Or, hey, I recognize that voice. Isn't that Edward Herman? Or isn't that guy that, you know, died a while ago? Not a single person thought that it was robotic. So, you know, there's another really interesting application of synthetic media. What are the risks? You know, everybody already knows the risks in creating a deep fake that is so realistic that not only moves around, but also talks and potentially uses your data in order to form a relationship with you. Like that's profound, right? It's interesting. It's also highly, highly problematic. And when it comes to synthetic data, you know, there are really good use cases and reasons to use it. There are not so great use cases to use it. And it's not always clear whether a data set is using synthetic data. So it, you get to a certain point in the product chain and it's very unclear how decisions are being made. So I think the risks have to do with intentional obfuscation, you know, being very opaque with where information is coming from, you know, and then all the other stuff that you already know, like spoofing a CEO and having the CEO say something and moving a market. I mean, look at what has happened with Elon Musk in the past,
right?
You know, when he's tweeted something. Now imagine multiple permutations of that synthetically generated and targeted ahead of an earnings call or something, you know?
Yeah, it's very, very scary. Now one of the ways that we could use market forces to reel in some of these concerns about AI is that we could encourage investors to understand it and sort of demand accountability and safety. You know, it's part of one of the things we're hoping to do through this podcast over time as well. And so it ties into one of the movements we've seen in investing over the past decade or two, which is this ESG movement. So I'm curious, do you have an opinion on what would ESG criteria look like for AI-focused companies? Where would investors lean in and what kind of things would they demand from AI-focused companies?
I think one of the problems with ESG criteria is that it's easy to set the criteria, but it's really hard to score them or to show your progress as a company, because some of those data points are kind of squishy, or they're just not, you're not collecting like quantitative data. It's not the same thing as like a lead certification. You know what I mean? So right. I think we should recall the name of this podcast with Amy is natural language processing for an hour. but I actually think that's it. So if you're if you're a company that uses AI well, or if you're an AI focused company, I think building some solutions or thinking through how can we extract from our meeting notes are just the kinds of things that we're doing as a company. Is there a way to extract insights that show movement one way or the other on those ESG criteria? But maybe separately from that, the governance piece of this is really rough for a lot of companies, especially when I'm talking, like when I meet with executive teams and boards, nobody wants to talk about data hygiene. Like that, like the easiest way to get people right. to like glaze over is, you know, let's talk about our data governance and our data hygiene practices. Like nobody wants to talk about that.
Right.
And so they don't until there is some kind of major problem. I was actually in a meeting with a company when news about FireEye broke, and some of the people that were in that meeting were involved in some way in that. And it was interesting to me that a lot of people had no idea. There was a stark contrast between the people who were absolutely horrified and the people who sort of didn't care because they didn't quite get what was going on. And I guess my point in saying this is governance should rise to the level of, at the very least, interest within every organization's executive management team.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think one of the challenges is I think people, you know, to your point, struggle with it in general, but I think they also don't know what to think about and what to look for with respect to, you know, trying to impose governance on AI, right? It's a fast moving space and all that kind of stuff. You know, they don't really know where it's going. So,
yeah. And I think part of it's politicized too. I mean, it's kind of become, you know, unfortunately, AI, governing AI has become sort of interchangeable with breaking up big tech, which has become interchangeable with, you know, red and blue state politics. And, you know, that's insane. We have to be able to have a realistic, you know, a good conversation about these things. And people shouldn't be picking sides on regulation based on, you know, what quite frankly are pretty unrelated political arguments, I would say. But I think I have a different viewpoint on regulation too than most, which is I think punitive measures are not the right way forward. I don't think regulation is going to help us out of the situation we're in. I think we have to figure out how to incent organizations, companies, developers, you know, to make better choices.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think that's a good perspective. So one question I like to wrap up on that's not technical and not directly related to AI is just that, you know, have a lot of interesting people on the podcast with interesting backgrounds. And so for the listeners, I kind of always like to, you know, to ask you, what is one piece of like life advice or career advice that you've been given or that you've read that has really benefited you that you'd like to share with everybody who's listening?
I would say it has to do with asking questions. There's a really terrific management consultant and thought leader named Hal Gregerson, who sort of has built a whole body of leadership around asking questions, asking better questions. It's interesting. I spend a lot of my time in front of executives, and I'm always curious about who in the room is asking questions, who's not. And I know there's a lot of emotion related to asking questions in front of your peers. And then, you know, there's the people who like do the thing where they ask questions all the time because they don't really have anything else to contribute. So their contribution in trying to sound smart is asking like ridiculous questions.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But I think having the courage to ask really great questions and thinking about how you're asking questions and, you know, it's something I think about a lot. And I do a lot. I am very curious and I'm not embarrassed about my curiosity. I'm also not embarrassed to say when I don't know something. But I'm also now in my mid 40s and I guess, you know, I've got the luxury of being in my mid 40s and no longer caring what people think.
Right.
But there you go.
Yeah. I had an early job where, I was at a tech startup that hired a COO, and I remember he'd been very successful at a bunch of places. And he came in and he started sitting in executive meetings and he was always asking questions. And I remember after the first time or two, I thought, man, this guy doesn't know anything. He's the dumbest guy in the room. But then what would start happening is I realized he asked questions about things that I thought I understood. And then when I heard the explanation, I was like, wow, I didn't understand that. And then I realized he was the smartest guy in the room, right? So I think there's a lot of truth to that.
I don't know if I should share this or not, but I guess I'm going to anyways. I was doing some stuff. It was not a client. It was a volunteer activity, but it was a volunteer activity with some other professionals. And I got irritated because I was the person in the room that had more technical knowledge, and I couldn't quite ever gauge how much technical knowledge everybody else had. So, and I wanted to make sure we were having a good, robust conversation. There were a couple of people who would take what they would take what I said, repackage it, and then pass it off as if it was their own original idea. Rather than stopping to say, hey, I don't quite know what that means, or hey, can we, you know?
Yeah.
So I inserted the word Sherpa as a verb in these meetings. It's like, you know, when it comes to, pick something. When it comes to blah, 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 AI, we really need to Sherpa. Like normally you would Sherpa that and then you would go and do blah. And I was curious to follow around the room that word and see what happened. And sure enough, like by the end of the day, there's like two people who are using that word Sherpa as a verb. And I was just like, you know, anyways.
Yeah.
That was a horrible thing I did when I was much younger.
That's okay. As another career hack for people who are in that situation. Well, Amy, this has been awesome. Very fascinating stuff that you guys are working on. I would encourage everybody to check out your Tech Trends report. You can visit the Future Today Institute. Amy Webb, thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Rob.